From their studio in the Feeding Arizona building in Youngtown, Arizona, it's the Boomer and the Babe Show with Pete Peters and Deborah Brown. Join Pete and Deborah and their guests as they give voice to 78 million baby boomers from coast to coast and border to border. Now here are the Boomer and the Babe, Pete Peters and Deborah Brown.
Yes, indeed. And here we are. It is the Boomer and the Babe Show. Good morning to those on the West Coast. Good afternoon to those on the East. This is the Boomer and the Babe Show on Thursday, October 11th, 2012, broadcasting from our studio, not in Youngtown, but in Sun City, Arizona. We've got to change that intro music, that bumper music, get that straightened out. But I'm Pete Peters. Deborah's not going to be with us. She's with some other clients today, some involved in some of the book publishing activities of what we do, the mini books and the ebook publishing. We invite you, however, to visit boomerandthebabe.com, see what we're involved in there. And also, we're involved in something brand new to us. It's publishing a series called The Camel Sisters. It's about reading, and reading is fundamental, and we're hoping to engage young children 3 to age 8 as parents and grandparents, hoping they'll be able to learn to read and learn to comprehend. And also the Camel Sisters will have their travels, and they will also be discussing with the youngsters things such as good citizenship and caring for the environment and all the things that I think most of us are really interested in and having our children take care of in their days when they become young adults and adults in this society. So please, if you'd like to support that project, that's on the front page of boomerandthebabe.com, and we would appreciate any support you would like to give. The Camel Sisters are all about the kids and all about making sure that the longevity of learning and learning to read is tantamount in today's society. And if you're not learning to read at a third grade level, you have probably, chances are, studies indicate that you are losing a lot of possibilities in your life if you're not reading by the age third grade. So that's very important to us. We have grandchildren, and we really think that's really a cool thing. So we're working on that. Our guest today is Mr. Eric Hill. Eric Hill is the founding president and CEO of the Arizona Foundation the Alzheimer's Foundation of America. And he's been doing this work now for about 10 years, I believe. Eric, welcome to the Boomer and the Babe Show.
Thanks so much. Pete, the last name, by the way, just is Hall, H-A-L-L.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I get that actually quite often. It's quite okay.
I'm sorry. That was my error. Eric Hall. Tell me, Eric, if you could give us your, what we call your two-minute movie, that being a little bio of what you've been doing in the past and how it is that you came to found the Alzheimer's Foundation of America.
Sure. I've been in the not-for-profit world probably for well over 20 years now in various levels of responsibility, creation, and executive leadership. I personally have a connection to this disease by a family member as I was growing up, whose illness at the time was actually diagnosed as senility. And actually now we sort of understand a lot of that as being what we would call Alzheimer's disease now. You know, but at this point, Pete, really almost every week as I travel, you know, I have this incredible ability to come across families coast to coast who are engaged daily, you know, providing care for a loved one with Alzheimer's or Alzheimer's disease or a related illness. And what I really find now is my motivation really comes from them. This population is growing, you know, exponentially. It really has very little voice. It needs individuals, you know, to step up and to really speak for it. And so the opportunity, as I see it, is just incredible to really make an incredible difference for these folks and to really offer them a voice, but also, as the foundation does, you know, resources, support, guidance, just to let them know that they're not alone. And so the foundation was established 10 years ago. I'm the founding president and CEO. And regrettably, you know, the organization continues to grow because of the growing number of individuals in our country who are impacted by Alzheimer's and their family members. And so I'm glad to say that the foundation is here. Regrettably, you know, it would be nice if Alzheimer's disease was not an issue at all.
Well, it would be. There's no doubt about it. And I was struck by when you mentioned that you had one of your first notices of Alzheimer's as a family member that was said to have be senile or have senility. I had that same situation, quite candidly. My grandfather, my father's father, was forgetful and very easily confused. And I remember that he was staying. He came up from Florida to spend some time with us, and he didn't want to fly back. He just didn't want to be on an airplane. So my dad put him on a bus with the hopes that he would be, well, with the thought that he was going to be picked up by somebody at the other end. But along the way somewhere, and I believe it was somewhere in Georgia, he got off the bus at a wrong stop and was confused and couldn't find his way back to the bus and was arrested walking down the middle of the street in one of the streets in somewhere in Georgia. And they managed to get him back and basically without any kind of an incident. But nonetheless, it was said that he was senile or he had hardening of the arteries.
Sure.
Was another diagnosis at the time, but I think absolutely,
you know,
right.
Given all the information that we have, you would think that there would be just more of a general knowledge among consumers of exactly what Alzheimer's disease is and you know, some of its warning signs and its developments. But the reality is, you know, we're not getting a lot of really good diagnosis of this disease across the country. You know, physicians, families, you know, everyone is still on a learning curve here. The disease does not have as an aggressive education pattern as, say, hypertension or cardiovascular disease has had in the past. Diabetes has now. So there are still enormous gaps to really getting everyone fully aware and educated about what to look for, how to be proactive, how to hold a conversation with your doctor, and in return, you know, for doctors also to, you know what to look for and to actually be keen enough to go ahead and to diagnose and to get proper diagnosis if they're not aware. So we still have a long ways to go. So even though senility is probably not used very often as a term, you know, hardening of the arteries is something that is being used. Another piece that is very common that we're finding still to this day is that, well, you know, as you get older, you know, this is one of the byproducts is a memory loss. And, you know, we simply know that that is not true. So we've come a long way, but yet we still have a long way to go on the journey.
Absolutely. And we had a doctor on just yesterday, as a matter of fact, and the discussion we were having was with regard to mental illness and how mental illness is often not diagnosed. And it might be the case where a person is depressed, and they might be depressed, but in reality there might be some other illnesses that are involved, or the mental illness might be causing some other illnesses to be diagnosed. So let's assume for a person that is terribly depressed, the depression could cause them to have memory loss, could cause them to have many other things that might be symptomatic also of Alzheimer's, and then they start treating them for Alzheimer's, and and it may not be Alzheimer's.
There's no connection. No, you're absolutely right, and it is really important that proper diagnosis take place. And I understand that, you know, doctors' times are really tight and primary care providers are very, you know, filled with a day full of patients to see. But this is one that we really can't afford to get wrong. Not all memory problems mean that you have Alzheimer's disease. Many are reversible. You mentioned, you know, one of the byproducts or one of the forms that, you know, depression or one of the impacts depression could have is exactly that, you know, a type of memory loss, a vitamin B deficiency, stress, thyroid issues. All of these can have byproducts of memory loss. So everyone who simply believes that if you have any type of memory loss means that you're at some level or engagement or process of having Alzheimer's disease, you know, is just really incorrect. And so more often than not, you know, if you reach a certain age and you're complaining about memory problems, there's this media connection that, oh, it's Alzheimer's disease. But, you know, the Alzheimer's Foundation of America has been pressing very hard for proper diagnosis. We've been doing this a number of ways through education and the like, but probably our most popular and probably most recognized initiative is National Memory Screening Day, which is November 13th, this November 13th coming up. It's called Memory Screening Day simply because it's an educational event, and it's not talking about Alzheimer's disease, but rather it is talking about what is seen as the most common manifestation of Alzheimer's disease, which is memory loss. But again, these are free, confidential memory screenings, and folks can go into, there's literally thousands of sites across the United States participating, and folks can find those sites at our website at www.alzfdn.org. But there, it's an opportunity that if people have concerns, you know, that it's a first step. It's simply seeing whether or not there's an indication that you might have a memory problem, and if so, you're given some education, some materials, some questions to ask your doctor so that you're getting properly diagnosed about what is the exact cause of your memory problem, your cognitive impairment as you're experiencing it. So, you know, we need to fine-tune this. We simply can't say that all memory problem is Alzheimer's disease, and that is part of the fear and the stigma around this disease. But we're also doing people a great disservice if it is a type of memory problem that is reversible through, you know, change of prescription drugs. Some combination therapies actually cause, as a byproduct, some memory loss. I mean, there are many issues that need to be eliminated first before we end up with a diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease.
Well, for the purpose of diagnosis, I guess, how is Alzheimer's currently being defined? What is Alzheimer's as its best definition as we exist in its state today? What people, doctors, professionals are looking for when they are looking for a diagnosis of Alzheimer's? What is it?
Sure. So the technicality behind all this, Pete, is the definition of Alzheimer's disease is that it is a progressive degenerative disorder that attacks the brain's nerve cells or neurons, resulting in loss of memory, thinking, language skills, and behavioral changes. So it is a disease of the brain, and we've all had, you know, in school, you know, biology, we all learned about neurons in the brain. We all learned about the electricity that travels between neurons, which causes us to be able to recall or have memory. And so this disease directly impacts those neurons and does not allow that type of synapsis, that electrical current passing from neuron to neuron, again, which causes us or allows us to have memory. It impedes that process, and the disease is progressive. There are arguments about when exactly, you know, Alzheimer's disease actually begins. There are some folks that are now saying that Alzheimer's disease is actually a pediatric disease, that it can start as far back as our childhood, and it takes, you know, our lifetime, if you will, or a period of time in order to for it to become fully manifest as the disease that we now recognize. But it is 90% diagnosable, you know, before, you know, while a person is alive, 100% obviously with the use of an autopsy. But the damage to the neurons causes also a shrinkage to the brain, which minimizes one's capacity. And so it is very much a very real disease. It is a type of dementia. Dementia is a clinical term, an umbrella term, that really speaks to and identifies cognitive impairment. And so Alzheimer's disease is 60% of all cases of dementia, but there are other types as well, Parkinson's, Huntington's disease, Pick's disease, vascular dementia. All of these are also dementias in the sense that they all share cognitive impairment. But there is a way to be diagnosed. There are some treatments that are available. We do not have a cure, regrettably, Pete. I wish I could sit here and say that we were closer to that. We're simply not. We're not sure what the cause of Alzheimer's disease is, and because we lack that knowledge, we lack a cure. However, the drugs that are available, the therapies that are available, can offset the progression of the symptoms of this disease, which would allow people to have better recall for a longer period of time, better memory problems for a longer period of time, better behavior, a lack of really some of the behavioral challenges that come with Alzheimer's disease. But the issue really, Pete, is we're a country that we're used to when we get sick, we go to a doctor, we're diagnosed, we're given a pill, we go home, we get better. And that is simply just at the moment not the state of Alzheimer's disease, but my hope really lies in the incredible people I have met across the world who are truly passionate and compassionate researchers who are really putting their life into this to really make a difference.
Well, as you were giving us that information basically about the definition, if you will, I wrote down a couple of things that came to my mind. First of all, is it correct that there is no medical test? In other words, is it the case that there is no blood test type of thing, that urine test, blood test, whatever, that that indicates presence of Alzheimer's?
That is correct. The diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease really requires the ruling out of other causes of the memory problem or cognitive impairment that you're probably experiencing. So, at the moment, we do not have an absolute assured test that would indicate or define this as specifically of the Alzheimer's type, if you will. But again, the difficulty, the challenge is that we're not really sure what the cause is. So until we do, that type of test and a cure are really kind of fleeting at the moment.
I've heard discussion of plaque in these neurons that are blocking this transmission of the and closing off the synapses and so on. What is plaque? Has plaque been proven to play a role?
So, Pete, you're referring to what's called the beta amyloid theory. So inside the brain, for lack of, very high technological scientific jargon, there is a development of a substance, a goop of sorts, if you will, that formulates in the brain. This is generally present in mostly all the cases of individuals with Alzheimer's disease, and somehow this substance that is built up in the brain, again, we don't know where it comes from. We're not sure what its purpose is or what its real purpose is in the brain, but it definitely has something to do with Alzheimer's disease to the best as we could tell at the moment. The difficulty is, we're not absolutely sure, whether this is a natural manifestation that taken to an extreme causes what we are now considering Alzheimer's disease. My reason for making that statement is this type of beta amyloid, this plaque that you're referring to, is present in individuals you know, after they have passed, that have had no signs of Alzheimer's disease as we would understand it. And so the fact that it is present there sort of raises the question of, you know, what exactly is this plaque? What is this development, and how much does it play into the cause of Alzheimer's disease? So that is a very valid theory that is being worked on and really being researched, and more data is being collected. But there are others now who simply believe, you know, other researchers, scientists who believe that perhaps this is a perfect storm of sorts, that, you know, at a certain point in time that there are numerous pieces that come together, this beta amyloid, this plaque being part of it, but there are other pieces as well, that the composite of those three together, or four pieces that might come together, you know, would be the cause of what we consider Alzheimer's disease. The reason I preface that about, you know, when it might happen, Peter, is, you know, everyone thinks that this is a disease of the old. Everyone feels that, oh, you know, people in their 70s and 80s get this disease. But, you know, statistics show that it's generally 1 in 8 over the age of 65, 50% over the age of 85. But there are numerous situations, hundreds of thousands right now, some 600,000 cases in the United States of people in young onset is called, meaning these individuals are in their 30s, 40s, 50s, and they indeed have been diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. So we as a society, you know, need to understand that this is not a disease of the old, or just of a disease that would impact just elders, but it is a real disease that does not discriminate, though it is more apparent, and age is a prevalent risk factor for Alzheimer's disease. That is not entirely the only situation or status that we would find this disease. So there's a lot that we need to take a look at and understand and educate in this regard as well, because I do believe, we have very limited understanding across the entire healthcare continuum. And because of that, you know, perhaps not proper diagnosis is taking place, and most importantly, probably not really good care as well. So, again, you know, we've come a long way, but, again, there's a long way yet to go in education.
Is the onset, the young onset or the early onset of Alzheimer's, the cases, are they increasing in number, or is the diagnosis increasing the number, if it's increasing at all?
I would say, you know, Pete, yeah, that's a very good point. I think across the board, I would say that there is more diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease, you know, both in young onset and, you know, folks in their latter years as well. However, I believe it is simply because, you know, there is more knowledge, there is more reputation, if you will, around this disease, and so the diagnosis is taking place. Many people will argue that maybe some of the 5.1 million Americans who presently have Alzheimer's disease, that perhaps those diagnoses, you know, are not verified as being of the Alzheimer's type. So there's a lot of discussion taking place about, you know, exactly what is the population that is impacted by this disease, and how much really good diagnosis is taking place. And that's why I would tell, you know, listeners that if you have concerns about yourself or about your loved ones, you know, to start a conversation with your doctor. And if your doctor is not specialized in this area, you know, to please ask for a referral so that you could see a neurologist or a geriatrician or a geriatric doctor who can really sort of speak to exactly what it is that is happening in your own experience or in the life of your loved one. Proper diagnosis is really critical, again, simply because what if it is something that is reversible?
Also, another thing that came to mind as you were talking earlier about the definition, dementia is the broad term. if I'm thinking of this correctly. And underneath the umbrella of dementia is Alzheimer's and many other diseases. It's not the other way around. Alzheimer's is not the umbrella that dementia is under. Is that correct?
That is correct. So dementia really speaks to a clinical presence. It's a clinical term that speaks to the presence of cognitive impairment. Other pieces as well, but cognitive impairment is a big part of what is typically considered a dementia. And so Alzheimer's disease exhibits that type of behavior, that type of manifestation, and so is considered one type of dementia. Again, probably about 60% of all cases of dementia are of the Alzheimer's type.
And you also mentioned medications, and you said that medications may have some effect in delaying or restricting the advancement of the disease.
Yeah, the progression actually of the symptoms of the disease. So,
okay.
So here's the problem: in the absence of cure, the priority, what is really precious and valuable, is quality of life. How long can we give as many good days as possible? And, you know, the challenge, I guess, is, you know, that the drugs that we presently have seem to be able to do just that. They're able to offset the symptoms. However, the disease is not stopped or reversed or halted in any way. So the disease continues to progress, but some of the symptoms related to the disease are minimized. Now, you know, none of us are happy about that. None of us are content about that. But I have to tell you, Pete, you know, traveling, you know, as much as I do, talking to families coast to coast, the one thing that every single family has said to me is that they wish that they had one more day with mom or dad or grandma, grandpa, my spouse. Right now, I think our challenge is to see whether or not we can offset the symptoms for even a longer period of time. When you think about it, Pete, it's not typical. I mean, the AIDS virus does not have a cure. What it has are therapies that offset the progression of the symptoms of the disease, so that individuals with AIDS actually are able to live for a very long time, leading very ordinary, seemingly healthy lives. I think that's where we'd like to get with Alzheimer's disease. I mean, ultimately, we want a cure. But in the meantime, I think everyone would see it as progress if we would be able to delay, you know, the full-out onset of all the manifestations that come with Alzheimer's disease. If we can offset that for a longer period of time, so that a person would die of some other natural cause, I think we would consider that a win. So, you know, there are two goals here. One is to do that, and the other is to ultimately, you know, find the cure and or prevent and inoculate, perhaps even, you know, for Alzheimer's disease.
When my father had Alzheimer's, and he was taking a medication, and I think at the time there may have been only two. I don't know how many there are now, but at the time there may have been two. And the question from the neurologist was wrestling with is whether or not, or when is the time to change him from one medication to the other, because the first medication no longer seemed to be having any effect. And they were hoping that the next medication, or the other medication, as it were, may have some effect because it was slightly different in makeup and so on and so forth, apparently.
Correct.
But I also have heard that once somebody comes off of the medications, however many there are, they may have been able to slow the progression as far as the symptoms are concerned. But what's going on underneath? It's sort of like the duck floating on the water. They're calm on the top, but they're going like hell underneath. Once the medications are removed, the decline to wherever that underneath activity has been taking them is a very rapid decline to that low ebb. Is that the case?
Yeah, that is correct. So there are three medications that are available. There's Aricept, there's Exelon. Those are for, earlier stage Alzheimer's disease, if you will. And then Namenda is approved for mid-stage Alzheimer's. The combination of therapies of having taken, say, either Aricept or Exelon and Namenda, is very common. It's called combination therapy. And there has been seen to have some benefit of, offsetting the symptoms. Your point is well taken. If an individual does stop taking those prescribed therapies, that there is very common experience where there is a very rapid decline. You're absolutely right. Regrettably, ultimately, the disease in this case is going to win. Alzheimer's disease has no cure, and the treatments that it has, I would say no one is really very satisfied with, as far as being, the ultimate home run that we would all like to have in a cure or something that is quote unquote disease modifying that can change, impact, halt, stop, pause, or even significantly slow down the disease itself. Pete, we're simply just not there. And the reason why, in spite of this reality, that the Alzheimer's Foundation of America, promotes early diagnosis, is one for the quality of life issues that we talked about related to the individual with the disease, to try to provide as many good days as possible for them, for their own sake and for the sake of their families. But the other critical piece here, and Pete, you and I were talking about this right before the show, is that, this is a disease that, impacts the individual with the disease hardly, for sure. Every disease, as we were sharing, is terrible. Every disease has its pieces, its developments that, is really just, is just bad. But this disease has this keen ability of stripping away, the very personhood of an individual. I say that because we as people are made up of our memories. We are a combination of a lot of what we've experienced and who we know and how we relate really comes out of a lot of what we've learned and experienced in our lives. This disease has the ability of slowly stripping that away. Besides that individual who is impacted with this disease, equally across the country, there is generally 1 to 4 primary caregivers for that individual. So there are families that are committed to providing care for that individual with Alzheimer's disease. And it is really important for that family to have the diagnosis as early as possible so that they can plan, literally plan, for what this disease looks like, what their needs will be financially, what constitutes good care, what am I and my family going to be expected to do to care for this loved one who's part of our family. And I say that, Pete, with a lot of passion, because the foundation is bombarded daily. We have thousands of folks who contact us monthly, and I would say the vast majority of those folks are reaching out to us in absolute crisis and chaos. They have just found out there's a diagnosis. They've had their loved one diagnosed because there's been some event, some major event that's taken place that has probably threatened the safety of their loved one. They got in a car and they drove and they couldn't find their way home and the police had to bring them home, or they went for a walk and they got lost and they didn't know where they were, or they found that, they went to the bank and withdrew all their money. Some event has taken place that drives people to bring their loved one for a diagnosis. Most of the time they know there's something wrong. They know that and can sort of perceive that there's something not just quite right, but no one's being proactive. And so they take their loved one, they get this diagnosis, and now all of a sudden they realize, that their loved one is really in the grips of this disease, And now they have to ask themselves a million questions about finances, medical care, legal responsibilities. The emotional burden just becomes absolutely overwhelming. And so I believe early diagnosis is really critical, both for the individual, but most importantly also for the family. That is really the core and the heart of care for this disease coast to coast. If it was not for families providing the care for these millions of people, each one of these individuals would become the responsibility of the state or the federal government, and the cost is exorbitant and absolutely undoable. And caregivers really need to be seen and respected as the true heroes that they are, and even more heroic in the sense that because of the fear and stigma that comes with Alzheimer's disease and the diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease, many of these caregivers provide care in solitude, in isolation. Their friends have fallen off. They don't know how to address this, what to do, how to hold a conversation now. Their own families have emotional, you know, turmoil because of just how bad this disease is, and now their loved one is exhibiting these behaviors, and they're forgetting, you know, who they are as family members, and there's just an enormous amount of burden that comes with this, and families step up not out of obligation or responsibility. Pete, I think caregivers of all types, and especially in this case with caregivers of individuals with Alzheimer's disease, they do this out of devotion. They do this out of love. And when you hear their stories as often as I do, it is hard not to hold them high and to really tout their honor and their dignity.
Well, I want to get into more of the ripple effect of what the Alzheimer's diagnosis can do to individuals and families and so on and so forth. Before we do that, I've got some messages that I generally play about halfway through the program. So let me do that, and we'll come back and we'll start talking about these ripple effects and also about costs and so on and so forth and how it affects finances as well as emotions. So let's do this, and we'll be back in about 3 minutes.
Boomer the Babe are the publishers of Boomer Series books. Our authors have their own shows on the Boomer the Babe Network. We encourage you to listen. Ron Naraki, author of the forthcoming book, The 10 Commandments of Investing, is the host of Wealth DNA, a financial show about real estate investment. Learn how to build and manage your portfolio. Ron hosts the show, and he always has good information to pass along, as do his guests. Listen to Wealth DNA on the second and fourth Monday of the month at 8 a.m. Arizona time. Tom Liggering's another Boomer Series author. His book, Success or Failure, The Choice is Yours, is the basis of the show he does with his broadcast partner, Dr. Terry Munther. Listen to Success or Failure with Tom and Terry on the fourth Wednesday of every month at 9 a.m. Arizona time. Learn how you can maximize your performance in business and in life. The methods you employ can either help or hinder. The choice is yours.
Hey, folks, John Bloom here. When I'm not broadcasting for the Cardinals or Suns, I've been spending the last couple of years with my friends building the fastest-growing online golf community in the great state of Arizona. Before you book your next round of golf here, go see what golfers just like you are saying about the courses you want to play at golfmix.com. You'll get the most authentic feedback from golfers giving you information you need before you spend the money you've earned. While you're there, write a review of the last course you played and get $10 off your next purchase at Vans Golf Shops. And enter into the Greenskeeper of the Year contest for a chance to win a foursome at the home of the Waste Management Phoenix Open, the stadium course at TPC Scottsdale. Please join us for the next Golf Mixer, Saturday, October 6th at the Raven Golf Club at Verado, and play a hole with PGA Tour winner Aaron Oberholzer and world-long drive champion Brian Pavlett. You can find details on golf mixers, tournaments, charity events, junior golf, and more on our statewide golf events calendar. Just check out Golf Mix, Arizona's leading golf course review site and mobile app. What are you waiting for? At golfmix.com.
The Boomer and the Babe are proud to be affiliated with Valley View Community Food Bank, where the food is always free. Valley View is now serving Phoenix from their new 36,000 square foot location at West Peoria and 107th Avenue in Sun City, Arizona. The new location houses the Food Bank, Feeding Arizona, and the Valley View Thrift Store. Feeding Arizona delivers food to other food banks and food pantries that are in need. If you're looking for a 501c3 to support, go to valleyviewcommunityfoodbank.com. All donations are welcome, be it food, money, or volunteer hours. No donation is too small. Get a hold of Jesse Ramirez, founder and director, and say, I want to help. Valley View Community Food Bank, where the food is always free.
And we're back. This is the Boomer the Babe Show. It is October 11th, 2012. It's a Thursday, and we're discussing Alzheimer's disease with Eric Hall, who is the founding president and CEO of the Alzheimer's Foundation of America. And Eric, we have a gentleman on the line. His name is Neil Farmer, and he has some questions for you. He says his father has Alzheimer's, so I'm going to connect Neil right now.
Sure.
Neil, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead and ask Eric your question.
Hello, Eric.
Hi, Neil.
Hey. Yeah, we, like a lot of the families, I mean, like you were saying, you have endless calls and endless discussions about the families and stuff. My father was in Korea. And we've read so in this process, you know, we started reading and reading a lot of material, trying to understand this. And your comment about, well, they still don't understand it. But in our society, is it not true that Alzheimer has become a more prominent disease in terms of the a number of people, or percentage-wise, the number of people that have gotten the disease?
Yeah, sure, Neil. So, you know, right now, the number put forth by the National Institute of Aging, a federal agency, is that there's 5.1 million Americans. That number of 5.1 is probably about 9 years old now. So I think it's really easy to incrementally add another 10 or 15% to that number, and probably on top of that, you could probably add another 10 or 15% of people who are exhibiting issues and have concerns, but are not, you know, talking to their doctor out of, you know, the fear and stigma that we discussed earlier. So yes, you're right. There's more presence and recognition. The difficulty, Neil, is that, It's not really blanketed yet. I think if you were to ask someone, you know, about hypertension, and you were to ask them about, you know, high blood pressure, I think people would be able to speak to, you know, some of the risk factors about that, about how important it is that you have it taken care of and talk to your doctor. If you talk to someone about cardiovascular disease, heart disease, you know, there's a common base knowledge I would say most consumers carry about those types of diseases. Regrettably, with Alzheimer's disease, you know, we're simply not there yet. And so a family will experience in their loved one, you know, some concerns and issues and events that, you know, really they know is just, odd or non-typical behavior for their loved one. And yet no one really thinks about going and holding a conversation with their doctor about it. I think another part, Neil, is, you know, we've been trained on how to talk about, you know, heart stuff or diabetes issues and things like that. But I don't think we've ever been trained as a society how to talk about problems we're having with our memory. I don't think we've been trained on how to really communicate, issues that we're having with recall or memory problems in general. I just don't think we've ever gotten there. If you remember the last time you went for a physical, they probably checked everything from your neck down, ears and eyes and nose probably too. But did they ever ask us, you know, and how is your memory? I just don't think it's part of the norm yet. You know, if you sit in a chair, they'll take your blood pressure, they'll check your heart, they'll do all that, but does anyone really ever ask, you know, well, about, you know, How's your thinking going? How's your brain doing? So we need to make that part of the national conversation so that we all become educated and much more proactive.
Well, in your knowledge concerning Alzheimer's, I read some material that one thing that does seem to be unusual about Alzheimer's is that those who have it have a slightly higher content of aluminum in their systems. Have you read about that, or is that actually a misnomer? Or
it's a misnomer. I mean, at the moment, there was a time, Neil, that and I remember this. It was a couple of years back where some research done, and of course, you know, the news reported on it. That, you know, aluminum was the cause of Alzheimer's disease. And the difficulty really came about because the foundation ended up bombarded by phone calls, you know, with honestly a lot of women who were calling because they used aluminum pots in cooking. They thought they gave their husband Alzheimer's disease. There's no real solid, clear science behind that. You know, as a preventative, is it possible that there are environmental issues that impact Alzheimer's disease? You know, there's a lot of research being done in that area, but definitively that it's Alzheimer's, that simply is just not proven.
Okay, are there any contributing factors that have been discovered that is a possibility of how to understand this?
Yeah, I think so, Neil. I think we understand that there are some very common preventative measures that can be done that would be helpful to mitigate the risks of Alzheimer's disease, and that means simply reduce the risk. Doesn't mean that you wouldn't end up getting Alzheimer's, but there's a lot of discussion about, you know, cardiovascular disease, a lot of discussion about the impact of high blood pressure on Alzheimer's disease, diabetes on Alzheimer's disease. Actually, just 2 weeks ago, there was a study that was put out about possible connections between diabetes and Alzheimer's disease. Again, you know, these are early studies, and we still have a lot more to learn. But I think the basic message right now, from a preventative message, would be a lot of the same language and messaging that we used around cardiovascular disease, about how important it is to take care of ourselves, to be exercising, to eat healthy, you know, to watch our fats, to watch our cholesterol, to, you know, to make sure we're eating vegetables and the like. All of those messages that are good for a healthy heart, most every single researcher would agree, leads to a healthy brain. And so I don't know how, but somehow in the process, we always sort of isolated the brain as somehow not being part and parcel of the entire body and organs as it is. But the fact of the matter is, I think we're getting a very keen realization that, you know, what we put into our bodies impacts, you know, our brain as much as our other organs as well.
Neil, I'd like to thank you for calling in. Excellent questions, and I appreciate your taking the time to call in. And I'm going to switch back now. We have some other things we got to touch base with.
Okay.
Thank you so much, Eric. And I'm just going
to
put you back on the hold situation. So if you'd like to continue to listen, you're certainly welcome to do so.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Okay, that was good questions there from Neil in Alabama. I'm glad he called in.
And I think Neil said that he was dealing with this in his own family, and I'm sure there's other listeners as well. And I would please ask, you know, anyone who would like to, you know, please reach out to the Alzheimer's Foundation of America. Our website, again, is ALZFDN.org, ALZFDN.org, or please call our hotline. We have social workers who are working right now who are available and would love to give some guidance and support and resource. You could call the Alzheimer's Foundation of America at 866-232-8484, 866-232-8484.
Great. Good information. Thank you for putting it in there. What I want to kind of go through yet before we wrap the show up is the costs that are associated with Alzheimer's, number one, and also the ripple effect. And we talked, you were alluding to a ripple effect as it goes through families and friends and other, even sometimes distant relatives, and how the, and let's talk a little bit about you've mentioned on a couple of occasions you've mentioned stigma, and
sure.
Let's talk a little bit about the stigma of Alzheimer's. I mean, anything, as you also alluded to here just briefly with Neil, there's not really a lot of information about the brain as an organ. It's just
right.
Something that is there. It's inside your head, and it can get rattled if you play football. It can
right.
cause concussions and cause other issues. But beyond that, that's where the actual study of the brain itself seems to me, at any rate, to be most prevalent as regards injury.
Yeah, I think in the public spectrum, you know, as far as common knowledge, I would agree with you. I mean, not to say that, you know, there's not intensive studies and neurological studies about the brain, but, you know, in the area of Alzheimer's disease, I think, you know, we lack some of the common knowledge. So what we do know about the disease, which everyone is aware of, is that memory loss is generally a manifestation, a very common occurrence of Alzheimer's disease. We probably have images in our mind of what happens and what a person looks like as they're in their latter stages of Alzheimer's disease. You know, we know that there are no cures, so there are no survivors for Alzheimer's disease. And we don't have a lot of people who have the disease who are actually able to step up and stand out and talk about it, simply because the disease generally has impacted their capacity to do so. So the disease as a whole, you know, has its challenges for education, for awareness, for advocacy. And so there are challenges, and all those challenges really lead to this fear and stigma. Recent studies have indicated, you know, Alzheimer's is now the sixth leading cause of death, and actually is more feared by individuals than having or getting cancer. So I think the case going forward is there is this fear and this stigma, and because of that, if people are aware that they're experiencing some problems, or if their loved one is experiencing issues or difficulties, they're not too quick to actually become proactive and talk to their doctor about it. One, because of the fear and stigma, and two, I believe it's because we just don't have enough knowledge about how to explain what it is that we're experiencing, you know, and so we don't know how to talk to our doctors. And that's why at National Memory Screening Day, again, next November 13th, across the country, free confidential memory screenings being provided. At that event, you know, we hand out, you know, a bulletin that inside indicates exactly questions you should ask your doctor to get proper diagnosis. But the impact on a family is enormous. The emotional toil all by itself, forget about the financial and all, we'll come to that in a minute, but just emotionally, someone that you've known X number of years and who has behaved and related with you in a certain way, now all of a sudden is not able to do that or is diminished in their capacity to do that. The hardest thing, Pete, that families have said to me was when their loved one forgot their name. You know, spouses who would simply no longer know, you know, who their wife or their husband was. And the aridity of that and emotionally is taxing. But so, you know, we as adults, however, have access to support groups. We can call the Alzheimer's Foundation of America. We could talk to our social workers. We can get our magazine. We could be connected to local resources. But our study showed that one of the 1 to 4 individuals caring for a person with Alzheimer's disease was actually a kid. And so the Alzheimer's Foundation of America started AFA Teens AFA-teens.org. It's a website for kids to learn about Alzheimer's disease and to interact with each other about the disease. And I think the reality is children are impacted as much as we are, and they're providing care. They're feeding and bathing and sitting and babysitting and staying with their loved one in the very same way adults are, but they have no capacity or no outlet. So the impact on this disease on the entire family unit is something that needs to be provided for and cared for as well.
Well, I understand that firsthand. I mean, there's a situation right here that we are limited. Deborah and I are very much limited with what we can do, where we can go, when we can go, to do things even related to business by the fact that somebody in this house has to be cared for. And as much to the protestations of go ahead, do whatever you want to do, we know it never works because when we come back, there's a very upset person. And it's very, very difficult. But I want to get aside from that. I want to get to this thing that you mentioned, almost like cancer versus Alzheimer's, and why maybe there's so much fear of one and not as much fear as used to be about the other. And I'm going to suggest that with the cure rates of cancer and the ability to control cancers nowadays, you can basically, in some shape, manner, form, or another, you can get the cancer cut out. It can be taken out of your body some way, somehow. Alzheimer's can't be taken out.
It is clearly a differential. There is no doubt. And I think most individuals would, you know, welcome a diagnosis of cancer because of the treatments that are available and because of very many of the cancers now have a very good success rate if they're caught early enough. And we've become very proactive around that. In this case, you know, it's not something that could be cut out, and we don't have really great treatments. And so I think it adds, you know, to everyone's fear, but all the more reason, again, about the importance of sustaining quality of life, the importance of actually properly planning. We were talking about finances earlier, Pete, and
yes.
The national average is anywhere between $16,000 to $36,000 a year out of pocket by a family to provide care for their loved one, depending on their stage of this disease. There is no Medicare reimbursement for in-home care in this regard. It's clearly recognized and limited to a custodial disease where families need to provide the care. It's an enormous financial burden. And you know, I don't think there's any family that isn't willing to make that lift, but families are asking for some type of help. I mean, even in-home care at this moment for this disease is not tax deductible. And so I'm not sure you're aware, Pete, but 18 months ago I was placed on an advisory council, 12 of us across the country, who were selected to help the government here in the United States put together the first federal national plan for Alzheimer's disease, how we would impact this disease, what we would put in place, what the needs were, a need assessment, how would we prioritize needs. And, you know, as part of that advisory council, I've been touting this message because it's the one piece that really is most needed by families. Families, again, are not asking for anyone to do this for them. It's not my experience. It's more the minority in that case. But they definitely do need some help and assistance. And in light of the fact that if these families stopped providing care, these loved ones, our citizens, our neighbors, would become responsibilities of states and the federal government overall. I think we need to be looking, in the absence of the cure anytime soon, what kind of infrastructure and support are we going to provide families who are caring for a loved one with Alzheimer's disease for up to 8 or more years after diagnosis?
Eric, if you could wave a magic wand and have something take place that would help to alleviate these issues that we've been talking about today, what would you wave the wand over?
I would ask those who are listening and our country to raise the voice. This population has no voice. They are impacted by this disease. That impact has minimized their ability, in most cases, to really speak out for themselves and their experience. Their families are engaged in 24/7 care. They're not able to actually advocate for what it is they themselves are dealing with day in and day out. It's going to take the rest of us to really raise a loud enough voice to say to the federal government, listen, a half million, $500 million for research for this disease impacting such a large number of Americans and will potentially, you know, impact all the more going forward is simply not enough. We need to be making this investment. And in the meantime, we need to be putting together, you know, the infrastructure to properly care for these people and to support families. So the magic wand, the wish list, if you will, is that people actually step up and start yelling out to, you know, our elected officials to really get behind the national plan as it was put out in November, in March, rather, of this year. And additionally, you know, they could come to the Alzheimer's Foundation of America website. We have an initiative called NAPA Now, the National Alzheimer's Project Act, NAPA Now, where we're collecting signatures for the president and elected members of Congress to ask them to actually begin funding the plan as it has been laid out, because right now it's a plan, but it has no funding, and it doesn't matter that we have a plan if we can't fund it. So folks should go to the Alzheimer's Foundation of America website at www.alzfdn.org. Click on NAPA Now. Please sign up. Give us your name. Participate in National Memory Screening Day, again, next November 13th, this November 13th coming up. Or please call the foundation at 866-232-8484 for either resources and support or just to lend a hand and say that you'd like to get involved.
Well, Eric, I tell you, this has been a very quick hour, as it always is when we're in subjects like this and have such great guests as yourself. I want to thank you for taking the time to be with us. We're going to have to do this again. There's so many things that were left unsaid here today, and I'm sure we can arrange possibly in the next 90 days or so maybe to have you back.
I'd be happy to do so. Thanks so much for having us, sir.
Well, I tell you, I'm very pleased that you were here. So I'm going to give you a call here shortly after we close off the show. There's a couple of other things I wanted to mention to you off air. And so I'll be talking to you shortly. And thanks again for being a guest on the Boom and the Babe Show.
At all. Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much. We certainly do appreciate it. Take care. And that was Mr. Eric Hall. Eric Hall was the Chief Executive Officer and Founding President of the Alzheimer's Foundation of America. I also want to thank Neil Farmer for contributing his questions to the conversation today. And with that, we're going to sign off, say goodbye. I hope everybody has a good rest of the day. Keep in mind, there's all kinds of things that can be done with regard to the scourge of Alzheimer's disease. And as Eric said, lend your voice, start shouting about it, telling people that more needs to be done. So with that, we'll say goodbye. Have a great day, everybody. And we'll see you again tomorrow with more fine guests. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the Boom and the Babe Show, where we bring interesting conversation to the world. Be sure to follow us on Twitter, where we tweet as Boomer and Babe, and on Facebook as PeteFeeders47. As always, you can friend us on Blog Talk Radio or sign up for our newsletter at boomerandthebabe.com. Email us at host@boomerthebabe.com with any of your comments. Remember, at 50, you're just getting started.